Blog Talk Radio.
Woo, everybody, you have just dug into the Gardening Network show. It is May 18th, 2015, and we are going to be talking dirt, as in soil, compost, what really grows great vegetables and fruit and plants and flowers, anything you can think of. And I'm Siobhan Shaw, your co-host for this episode, and I've got my shovel ready co-host, Lisa Sellers Roberts. Lisa, say hello.
Howdy.
And Donna M. Butler from Louisiana is on the line, always, always riding with me.
Hello, hello, hello.
And since Lisa is our resident expert on gardening, Donna knows absolutely nothing about gardening, and I was raised on a farm, so I do have some experience, let's say, I won't say expertise in gardening. We brought in a real expert from McIntyre's Garden Center in Georgetown, Texas.
Woo-hoo.
We've got Zach Zilzulka with us. And Zach, how are you today?
I'm doing very well. I hope you are all great out there.
We are good. I'm good in Louisiana. It's a storm going on right about now, but it's a good time to get my my little flowers watered, too.
Well, we're getting a break from the rain right now.
And this show is sponsored by Little Crop Circles. Little Crop Circles grow more in small spaces. LittleCropCircles.com. And Zach, I'm going to start you out with a very difficult question. Donna knows nothing about gardening. She hasn't grown a thing. She's only grown children and grandchildren in her life. She lives in Louisiana in a really humid, hot climate most of the year, right? And where does she start to grow great plants? Like, where does she start so that she has a garden that everybody on the street and in the town that she lives in are jealous of, over?
Well, it does start with the soil. Usually you have to figure out the content of the soil that you're starting with, but the first start, we've lost like 80% of our organic matter due to commercial farming / erosion, and so adding a good amount of compost would be a great start without knowing anything. Then, you know, from there, you basically need to get the pH correct so that your fertilizers will work the way they're supposed to. Also, the compost will have good bacteria, which will protect the plant from bad viruses, disease. Also, the soil acts like a buffer to toxification, overwatering, and that's what keeps the plants healthy.
Mm-hmm. So when you say composting, see, I have friends that garden, and I'm so jealous of them. I just want to fling dirt in their eyes, but just don't know which one to use, which soil to choose.
Which soil to use to throw at them? Yeah.
To throw in someone's eyes. When they say compost, usually it's like it's their garbage. I mean, is that a nice word for garbage? Like their banana peels and their apple cores?
Yeah, I mean, you can manufacture that at your house, or they do bag it and buy it in bulk. For some people, new to it, may just want to buy it because, it's not hard to compost, but it does take some space, and if it's done incorrectly, can become a mess. But basically, yeah, it's all organic matter that you can pile up. You need a good ratio, 1-to-1 carbon to nitrogen, and good moisture content, and you can break stuff down pretty quick if you turn that pile.
Okay. I guess I'll go the bag it way.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of times to start off with, that's the way to go.
Well, you know what? We compost, and it is smelly. Like, it's really bad. Right? Because you have to, and I have lots of friends here that compost as well. So then what you have to do is you have to have like a bucket maybe under your sink or on your counter if you want or something like that where all day long you're just throwing all this organic material in, right? Even your coffee grinds, correct?
Yeah.
And so it has to be sort of a part of your daily routine to take that out because if you know anything about rotting food, it smells in your house. So then you take it out and you take me from there, Zach. There's compost bins that people can use?
Yeah, there's bins. You can either put one together with just some, you know, hardware cloth or, you know, chicken wire. You know, anything that's going to let air go through there and moisture come out, you know, because you don't want a stagnant pile that's full of moisture because then, you know, you get bad bacterias and, you know, stuff in there that you do not want to introduce. So as airy as possible, of course, you if you can, keep the critters out because possums, raccoons, stuff like that. But, you know, really once you get a compost pile working, you know, and just don't ever harvest the entire pile so you always have that, you know, that working bacteria there. You know, you can feed that thing, harvest off of it, you know, for years and years and years, and even start other piles with the one that you originally started. And you really can't go wrong with compost because it will adjust pH as it oxidizes. It creates humic acid, which if you have alkaline soil is a great thing. Now, if you have acidic soil, you may have to balance that out, you know, and make it a little bit more alkaline. But it will hold moisture. And release nutrients at a slow rate, you know.
So you're talking about alkaline soil, acidic soil. How does somebody test their soil, say, in their backyard garden?
Most areas you have a county extension or some variant of, depending on how the state does it, that then is linked to a university. And you can either have them test the soil. You know, they have kits usually. They'll tell you how to take the sample. You kind of jot down what you're trying to do with the specific area, and they'll give you back analysis of you know what is in that soil, and parts per million depending on what it is, and a lot of times they'll break it down what needs to be added. A lot of times they're more commercial, and so they kind of tell you how to do it with chemicals. But if you go to a good shop, you know they should be able to convert that into organics. And in this area, you know, we're usually alkaline in the central Texas area. We're alkaline with zero nitrogen, high phosphorus, high potassium, which is really bad in the sense of locking up the soil and not releasing iron and zinc and stuff like that, which is a problem with fruit-bearing things because then the cell walls are real thin and disease and stuff like that, and rotting fruit will occur, like blossom end rot on tomatoes.
Okay.
Which is a calcium deficiency.
Oh, so you would want – that's a good place to go. Let's segue to that. So let's say you want to grow great tomatoes. What do you need in your soil?
It can't stay too wet, but it needs to stay evenly moist. Usually I would amend that in this area with a lot of compost. I might even – if I know that – I have a lot of clay. I might even put like expanded shale to put bigger particles in there so that it holds oxygen. And then maybe even like cocoa core. I would probably amend a good bacteria with the mycorrhizum and or drench it with a compost tea that I make up from worm castings typically and molasses. And then I might even treat that with a dolomite lime to supplement that calcium. And worm castings does have a chelated calcium in it.
Zach, I was wondering, what if Donna had planted some plants and if they started to turn yellow, how can she tell from her plants what is lacking in her soil?
That's good. That's a perfect question for me.
Usually if you have like yellow leaves on the bottom and it looks like the plant is starving, it's either going to be a lack of nitrogen. Your nitrogen is what basically it's the only it's unstable and it grabs all the other nutrients and takes them up. No other nutrient can translocate itself into the plant without nitrogen. So nitrogen is almost the most important, you know, element, part of your food. Now, that also can be the case if we're overwatering or it's just been raining. It can get very yellow, and that would be a lack of oxygen, which then all the elements then can't do what they're designed to do because of the lack of oxygen. And so you have to kind of start whittling down, like, okay, we see a lot of yellowing leaves lower down on the plant. That usually hints that there's a lack of some nutrient. And then we have to whittle down, is it because it cannot move it because of too much rain or something like that, or we're missing, our pH is out of whack? Once you start to whittle that down, you go, oh, well, you know, one of the easiest things to do is add a little bit of nitrogen. You never want to do a lot of nitrogen or a lot of anything because, you know, you don't want to just go be bouncing around, you know, just throwing things at it. And, you know, you've got to slowly feed it to find out the problem. And mentally think about, like, okay, well, we've had 2 weeks of heavy rain. Mm-hmm. You know, this is most likely where we start. Let's just, you know, let's try to maybe aerate it, you know, take a pitchfork and just poke holes so that it will dry and get a little bit more oxygen down in there.
You guys are both from Texas, Lisa and Zach. You're both you're Austin, Texas, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Correct.
And you guys have been going through how many years of drought?
5 to 6 years of drought.
Mm-hmm.
And this week, big shift?
Yeah. Well, we basically got our average rainfall over the last several weeks, you know.
The Pacific has brought in some storms for us, yes.
Correct. And we're seeing a lot of fungus because of it. And a lot of that has to do with not just the moisture, but the drought knocks out all the good bacteria that's in our soil naturally.
That's
and
right.
Now there's a void in there, and the first thing that always sprouts back is the bad. And so the compost tea, the good compost, and the worm castings, and then also having the carbohydrate, like with molasses, that will feed the good bacteria.
That's right. Got it.
And they're probably the best at fighting fungal problems in the dirt and on the foliage of plants.
So molasses, I just never heard of that in my life.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
So you add the molasses to the compost?
To your
soil? The manure or the fertilizer? Or?
Well, like for making compost tea, you add it like an ounce per gallon. Then your worm castings is like 1 to 3 pounds per gallon that you're making. But if you're just using the molasses, you could use a dry or a liquid, and it has the carbohydrate, which is the energy for the bacteria to colonize that area. And as we know, you know, in a void, something will sprout, and you would want that to be a good bacteria.
Okay.
So let's pretend that, let's fast forward, that everything that you guys said, I truly understand and truly have outside my door the right soil, the right everything, the pH level, all that good stuff, you know, and it's there.
Mm-hmm.
What would be, and I live in Louisiana, what would be the first thing, and I'm talking to you three experts, what would be the first thing that I would want to put in my garden? I'm looking for beauty. I'm looking for beauty, and I'm looking for something to go fast. Go ahead.
Like an ornamental plant?
Yes. An ornamental plant. So you're going to make me smart already on this gardening thing. I'm going to walk into the store and say, I'm looking for ornamental plants. Yes, ornamental plant. What can I do? Because I don't want this just to be a bunch of nice dirt in my yard. I would like to be able to see something right away.
Well, in Louisiana, I would look at you know, a lot of the hardy hibiscus, the saucer bells, altheas, you know, those are going to put out a lot of color. Of course, over there, you could probably get away with azaleas and hydrangeas, depending on the size. There's probably different salvias and irises that would bloom, like Louisiana iris. You know, kind of depending on the height, you could probably do magnolias for trees.
That's my favorite.
Yeah. And they have different heights of magnolias, like the saucer magnolias and the Randy magnolias. Then you got your standard southern magnolias. Dogwoods would be kind of a mid-size. I think you'll do crepe myrtles as well. That's usually across the south. That's like the lilac of the south.
Zach,
jasmine.
Say that she was planting edibles in her garden.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
What flowers would be nice to bring in the good beneficials?
I would say, all the alliums, which can be they're edible as well, but also marigolds. Because they control nematodes and they're kind of a canary in the coal mine for spider mites as well. You see the spider mites on them, you know that they're in the area, and so you need to start looking around. I always like zinnias. They kind of flash up, everything. What else? I like to grow ground covers as a mulch, like my sweet potatoes. I will actually mulch with the sweet potatoes when I have the space, because that'll keep the sun off the soil. And keeping that sun directly off the soil will, harbor a better space for good bacteria. And, and also plants like their root zone below 85 degrees. They will stop production once they're above that.
That's true.
Is
we
that
have that
right?
problem in the south.
That would be a problem in the south, and it would be a problem in the interior of the Pacific Northwest, which is where we live. And one thing that we find here is that all the cold weather vegetables like lettuce and peas and broccoli, they even right now they're starting to bolt because we're starting to get, 80 degree weather. How do people in the South specifically, because you guys are all there, and how do you grow things like that?
You grow them in the winter.
Like spinach and things like that.
Yeah, you grow them in winter. Basically, there's a season, September to November, that you can kind of plant. Of course, later in there, you will have to probably protect some of them, especially if they're young. And then again, you plant in like late January to probably mid to first part of February for ideal conditions for all your brassicas, like your broccoli, your kale, cauliflower, collards, stuff like that. Also your lettuce, but be about the same time. Our onions, we do what they call long day onions, which you plant in January, February, and then they're ready about June. So as soon as it's getting hot, they kind of fall over. And then that's when you harvest. And then basically, hopefully all that stuff is out of your way or you have enough room to do tomatoes in March, April. And I actually try to get away with a February planting, but it didn't work this year.
Well, we were lucky up here. We had a really early spring, so we planted a lot in late March, and it's the May long weekend here, and that's when most people are starting to plant. So we've harvested lettuce, mm-hmm. spinach, and the broccoli is forming, and it's actually the florets are starting to bolt a little bit. We got peas racing up the trellises, and everything's in. Beans are starting to pop up and things like that. And this is the Gardening Network you're tuned into. We've got Zach Zazulka from McIntyre's Garden Center in Georgetown, Texas. You can find them at mcintyresgardencenter.com. And Zach, I'm sure there's a way people can email you right there with questions, correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, cool. And you can always email Lisa Sellers Roberts right from our website, thegardeningnetwork.com. And I have one question for you.
Don't email me.
Don't email Donna.
Donna. Don't email. Let's not email me today.
Yeah, probably best is through the Facebook page, is probably best for McIntyre's.
So it's McIntyre's Garden Center, and it's McIntyre's-Garden-Center. I think that's how you find it on Facebook. And I want to know, how do people grow really big pumpkins? Is it something in the soil?
Well,
you
that,
know, those
that has
really
a,
big pumpkins.
That has a lot to do with your oxygen ratio. Usually sandier soils are better for that. You know, and then the rainfall, you know, just keeping a good cool root on there and then maintaining squash beetles in the south. They get on those vining vegetables and they will devour the plant will look great one morning. The next morning you wake up and it's just completely flopped over. The key is maintaining all those things. And usually I have better luck with a spring crop of big, large vining plants like that. I've never been successful putting one in for the fall and actually getting fall pumpkins or something like that, just because it's so hot, the insects are out. You know, that they're just attacking it as soon as that plant is 4 inches tall. But basically, you want to add some sand, get good aeration. Usually plant on hills instead of like in furrows, so that you're not swamping it down whenever you're irrigating or you get, you know, 5-6 inches of rain. And they do require a good spongy soil that stays evenly moist.
I've had success with that in flower beds, keeping it under an awning and a chicken.
Chicken eat the bugs?
Oh, so have chickens in your yard. Can most people have chickens in their backyards in the cities?
Well,
in Georgetown we can. There's actually ordinances that allows it, yes.
That's right. In Liberty Hill, too.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of urban farming stuff going on.
There is.
I'm house-sitting some neighbor's and house while they're away looking after their puppy dog. And the neighbors at the back, all of a sudden I hear chickens this morning because she's got a little hen house and it's just, you know, it's a typical city lot. And I'm thinking, is she can have chickens? And they were just squawking like something was in there, or they were laying lots of eggs.
They probably laid an
egg.
Yeah, that's another thing is, you know, there's a lot of new, well, they're not new, you know, like the permaculture ideas out there of the old ways of doing things with chickens, pigs, goats, you know, that you can run those animals after you've raised a crop to basically animal tractor that area, and they'll leave their manure, and you basically pin them up in that particular area. Even if it's in a small area, you just make sure they have the feed, the cover they need, and they're protected from anything that might try to eat them. You know, they'll chew that stuff and scratch it up pretty well, and then you move them to the next area.
They're great with aeration. All of them are. But you have to be careful with chickens, folks, because when you have baby new plants, they will eat them.
Yeah, it's almost, especially whenever you get into your brassicas and all the sugary, you know, high nutrition leafy grains, they just devour them.
They will. You have to be careful.
You know, that reminds me of a story. John was, we were gardening one year, and we were in a new place, and he had this big, beautiful garden, and everything was just starting to sprout. And every morning he'd go out, and more of his little plants would disappear. They'd be chewed off, or actually, like, the complete plant was gone, the seed and everything. And finally, he caught the pheasant.
that was
kind of sneaking into the garden in the early hours of the morning. And this pheasant, we watched him. He would take a bean and he would throw it up in the air. He'd pull it out of the ground, throw it up in the air, and gobble it down. It was the most hilarious thing. And, of course, John was getting more and more frustrated because he would plant new ones every day for like a week. Finally, he heard the thing, because now it's getting, you know, it's like getting real confident that this is his, it's garden, right? Like, John
put it there for him,
stuff just for him. So, you know, all of a sudden I hear this clamor and clatter and yelling and screaming and, you know, this bird going, ah! Because John has run out after it. He's staring at the butt naked.
That's even better.
Oh, my God.
That's usually how it goes down.
Thank goodness the neighbors are. They amazing. I was just like, I'm not going to live this down. And that bird, he never came back again.
That was too much for
wow.
him.
Wow. Zach, I do have a question for you, too. Say Donna has a raised garden bed just right
mm-hmm.
outside her kitchen, and it is very, very moist, way too wet, because you know that plants like their feet to breathe.
Right.
How would you tell her to help with getting some of that moisture out of there so her plants will not succumb to death?
I would look for an expanded shell. I think in most areas you can find expanded shell. If not, look for a, you know, like a lava stone type material. You know, in different areas you may be able to get different. But main thing is you don't want it to adjust your pH too drastically in one direction. You know, like taking limestone stones would not be the way to do it. I would look for something neutral, and expanded shell, or even at a lot of hydroponic stores, they're selling recycled expanded glass, which would put a very airy, it looks just like lava, you know, lava stone.
Mm-hmm.
And even they're doing expanded clay pellets. And you could mix that in there, and that would give you a very airy texture. Of course, there's perlite. Most
and
haydite,
yes.
Yeah. But I like more of, you know, as closer to the earth as possible. The perlite is kind of a process of it's mined out, and then they heat it in these huge ovens and make it expand. It's kind of a process.
Yeah.
But that's why I like the expanded shell. It's pretty much a raw material that they just either crush down, or it's already that way. And you can mix that in. A lot of the rose mixes have it in there for well-drained soil. And, of course, sand, but you do have to be careful with sand and clay, because you could make concrete, and you don't want to do that.
And then you can take your little plant feet and throw them in the lake.
Yeah, and usually I stay away from manufactured sand, because that's limestone that's crushed up. You want a silica-based sand, like beach sand, you know, like a play sand, typically. I guess in bags is what you'd be looking for. But, you know, if it's staying wet, and you might also look and see if that moisture's coming from the roof line and see if you could redirect that moisture. You know, kind of, you know, maybe look in the engineer end and see if you can keep it mm-hmm. from entering the garden. As for structure, you would just look for an inorganic material that would breathe and hold oxygen.
Cool. So we're down to our last couple of minutes. Donna, any quick comments before we leave, or a final question for Zach?
Well, hopefully next week we won't tune in and I've made concrete. You know, all my little plant feet are stuck in it. And
yeah.
Hopefully that's not what we're going to be talking about next week. But, no, I mean, I've learned a lot. I even made a few notes and everything. I didn't know anything about the pH and all that. I just thought you got dirt, turn it, and put stuff in it. But thanks.
And there's
a
lot of at garden centers, you know, they have like little pH soil tests, and mm-hmm. a lot of times that's enough. I mean, you don't have to get too scientific. You know, like I said, the soil is the buffer to the plant. You know, it's where the lower digestive system of the plant is, and so it's pretty good about, you know, buffering itself out, long as we don't get too involved and do go too drastic with it.
And we
all right.
Lisa, one last comment.
Oh, thank you, Zach. Yes, yes, this is great information. I've done, like Don, I've done my homework and writing some things down, so thank you for this information.
Yeah,
definitely.
And please, everybody, support your local garden centers. People like Zach and McIntyre's Garden Center in Georgetown, Texas, have tons of great information. They know
mm-hmm.
they grow every day. They're growing for us and for the Grow Your Own communities all around the country, across the globe. Please get out and support them. Ask some questions. You can find Zach on Facebook through McIntyre's Garden Center. Check out their website, McIntyresGardenCenter.com. And please join us every Monday as Donna Butler, Lisa Sellers-Roberts, and myself, Siobhan Shaw, bring you more great information about gardening. And what next week we're going to talk about container gardening. And thank you, Zach. Thank you, Donna. And thank you, Lisa. It is time to dig ourselves out of here and say goodbye.
You're welcome. Go and grow.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Go and grow. Keep going.